Good morning. Open your Bibles to Genesis 2, and we're going to read from verse 18 this morning. We're continuing our study of marriage. Did y'all do your homework? Okay. It's not for a grade from me, but you got to deal with your spouse, so hey, that's between y'all. And there's more homework today, so it's going to start stacking up if you don't do it. Okay, last time we talked about companionship, God's purpose in marriage, and that when we stop sharing life together, the marriage erodes. We started with Genesis 2:18. Then the Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." So from the very beginning, that's what it was, companionship, that husbands and wives are going to be together. They're going to be living together, sharing their lives together. To use the wording from Malachi 2:14, your wife is your companion. So that's what we're basing all this on. There's a lot of theories and stuff about marriage out there. We're just starting at the beginning with the creator of marriage. He knows best. And this is the way he is framing the subject. So we're starting with that. Okay, so today, companionship part two. We're going to look at it in three parts here. Three things that spouses should know about each other. And we're going to start with this. I am here for you and always will be. This is our first commitment to each other. Look in Matthew 19, please. Matthew 19. Let's talk about the permanence of marriage. We've studied divorce and remarriage in detail in previous studies, and we'll continue to do that. We do that routinely. We're not doing that in this class. It's not going to be a detailed study of that. But we are going to read through Matthew 19 here and just note what Jesus said, because in the world there are different views about marriage. We're using the biblical view in this class. It's a Bible class. We're using the biblical view. In the world, you'll find different ideas, the ideas that, you know, ideally, marriage is permanent, but you never know. Things change, and we leave it. Some people start marriage with the view that it's temporary. It's like a job. You know, if I like it, I'll stay in it. If not, I'll change it. And then some people have the idea, probably the minority, but some would just say it's meaningless. Marriage is meaningless, doesn't mean anything, and so it's an archaic relic of the past. You don't really need it one way or the other. But in the Bible, marriage is important, and it's permanent. Matthew 19:3, some Pharisees came to Jesus testing him and asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" And he answered and said, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away?" And he said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery." The disciples said to him, "If the relationship of a man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry." But he said to them, "Not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men, and there are also eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to accept this, let him accept it." Okay, so this was God's intention from the beginning, is the way he words it there. From the beginning, this was the way it was set up. Jesus goes all the way back to Adam and Eve there. You see verses 4, 5, and 6. And then he gives the exception there in verse 9. The New American Standard, as much as I like it, gives a word that's way too broad there when it says immorality. The word is fornication. You look at the Greek word there, and your translation might reflect that. That's more accurate, fornication. So if your spouse cheats on you, you can put them away. You can divorce them, and if you want, you can remarry. And also, you see there in verse 12, you don't have to get married. Some people can't get married. Some people devote themselves to the kingdom of heaven, and so they just choose not to get married. But if you get married, it is a lifelong commitment. And so we see that from passages such as Matthew 19. Go backwards a few pages, please. Malachi chapter 2, last book of the Old Testament. Malachi 2, we'll read verse 14 again. Malachi 2, 14. "Yet you say, 'For what reason?' Because the Lord has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously, though she is your companion." That's what we noticed already, that companion wording. And then now notice, "and your wife by covenant." Wife by covenant. So that's what a marriage is. It's a relationship between a husband and wife, between a man and a woman, who have made a covenant to become one another's. A covenant is just an agreement between parties. And And so they've made this covenant, they've made this agreement to become one another. It's a binding agreement. It has no God-approved ending except death, Romans 7:2, and fornication, we just read in Matthew 19:9. And so besides that, it's a permanent agreement with no other God-approved ending. And I think we see God's wisdom in that. This is the closest human relationship. And so it takes work to maintain that. And God's wisdom is, start this with the mindset, you're in it forever. Divorce is not an option. We're not going into this as, we'll see how it works out, because there will be times when the marriage is not happy. There's just going to be times when we're in conflict, we're mad at each other, and all kinds of conflict comes up. There'll be times when we're sick, when a tragedy hits, when whatever, when we're stressed out, and you're just plain mad at each other. Marriage can't be one of those things we just say, well, just try it for a while, see how it's working out, and then go from there. We got to be all in, all in. So dating, maybe we could put it this way. Dating is like a voyage across the ocean. And then marriage is you landed on the beach and you burned the boat. We're not going back. We're here. Is that a bad analogy? Okay. Now that I think about burning something, I'm like, well, okay. Maybe that's the point is we're committed, right? We're there. We burned our bridges. We're not going back. So we have to develop that foundation in our thinking. We're in this for the long haul. And the wise thing to do, obviously, would be to put work into the marriage, given that. Given the fact that this is forever, you spend a lot of time working on it. You don't just assume, we get married and then, fairy tale princess, happily ever after, just magically. We put the work in to do our best to make sure that it's a strong marriage as God intended. It's happy and it's fulfilled. It takes two people. You can't do it all alone, obviously. But on your part, you're trying to do the best you can. So all other decisions we make are less than that. They take less time. Our career, our where we're going to live, where we're going to work, all that stuff can and does change. But this is supposed to last till the end, until death parts us. It's a permanent relationship based on that covenant we've made with each other. So the practical takeaway from all of that is don't let the D word enter your vocabulary. Just have in mind. We're in this till the end. We're going to make it work one way or the other. Don't use divorce as a threat, leverage in an argument. If you don't do the dishes, I'm out of here. Don't drop a nuclear bomb when you need a conversation. So this just is off the table. This is God's wisdom. You're in it till the end. Look in Hebrews chapter 13. I'm going to do a lot of talking here just to make sure we're getting through all that I want to get through this morning, but I will open up for comments here in a minute. Hebrews 13, think of what it means to know that God is here for us and God will always be here for us. So Hebrews 13, we're going to read verses 5 and 6. Not a marriage passage per se, but it does help us to think about the security we have in our relationship with God and how that helps us to focus on Him and not pursue and chase other things. Hebrews 13, 5, make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For He Himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we may confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? Okay, now we can walk away from God, but God is saying to us, I'm not going to walk away from you. If this relationship gets messed up, it's on you. He's not going anywhere. I will not forsake you. I will not desert you. And then the message here, the point that he's making here is about money. You don't have to go chase money because God is always going to be here for you. That's going to be your foundation. God will not desert you. And so I think there's a point there, a parallel to as we think about marriage. When we feel secure in marriage, it just changes. The tone of everything changes. When I know, I have full confidence that my spouse is not going to leave me and I'm not going to leave them, then that just changes the way we handle everything. We feel secure. We trust. We're not going to be deserted or forsaken. It makes us relax. I don't have to chase after other things. I don't have to keep my guard up. I don't have to pretend to be somebody else. I don't have to have a plan B and a plan C because plan A is secure. And this is what we're doing. We're sticking together. Okay, so again, we're looking for practical takeaways from this. Think to yourself, am I that kind of spouse that my wife, my husband knows I'm here from now on, that they can trust that about me? They can rely on me to be here till death. Look in Romans chapter 8. Similar point over here, this great passage we have about the love of Christ. Romans 8 and verse 33. Who will bring a charge against God's elect? God is the one who justifies. Who's the one who condemns? Christ Jesus is he who died, yes, rather he who was raised, who is at the right hand of God, who also intercedes for us. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? Just as it is written, for your sake we are being put to death all day long. We were considered as sheep to be slaughtered, but in all these things we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. So again, same question there. How does it feel for us as Christians to know that God loves us that deeply and that securely? That he is reinforcing that in passages like this, saying, I'm there, I love you, doesn't matter, these external things are not going to get to us. And again, no human love can match that divine love. We're not saying that. But to the extent that we can love like that, it strengthens our marriage. And again, the question for us, does your spouse believe that no matter what external force acts upon your marriage, that you are going to be there, that they can count on you to be there? And so even if they get a chronic illness, even if an attractive person wants to come along and have an affair with them, even if the inner laws are giving you stress, whatever, if job is, you lose your job, whatever in life comes along, all these external things that come along, can your spouse trust you're there and you're there to stay? Okay, back in the Old Testament again, please, Hosea this time. Let's look in Hosea chapter 2. The book of Hosea is, to me, at least one of the most emotional books of the Old Testament because it's about God's broken heart. God is picturing himself as the husband and Israel as the wife. And he is saying that Israel has forsaken him and played the harlot and cheated on him over and over again by going and worshiping idols. And so it's God's broken heart. Look in Hosea chapter 2, please. That's the running metaphor here. Chapter 2 and verse 2, contend with your mother. Contend, for she is not my wife and I am not her husband. Okay, so there's this introduction, this idea, husband and wife, God and Israel. Verse 7, Hosea 2 and verse 7, she will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them, and she will seek them, but will not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. For she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine, and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold. Verse 13, I will punish her for the days of the Baals, when she used to offer sacrifices to them and adorn herself with her earrings and jewelry and follow her lovers so that she forgot me, declares the Lord. In Hosea 6 and verse 4, chapter 6 and verse 4, what shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? For your loyalty is like a morning cloud and the dew which goes away early. And other verses we could pull from here, but you get the point. Why does God, think about the fact, why does God use that as a metaphor? Why does God use marriage as the metaphor? Here he is with Israel. He's in this covenant relationship with Israel. They're supposed to be obeying him. You know, Mount Sinai, all that. Ever since then, they're supposed to be his special people who are obeying this covenant, this law that came from Mount Sinai, that God gave on Mount Sinai. And they're not doing it. Time and time again, they've turned away from that. So God said, how can I illustrate that to the prophet Hosea? I'll illustrate it as some other permanent covenant that's supposed to be in place, marriage. And it's like you're married to me, and yet you've cheated on me with all these different idols. And so, again, that just reinforces in our mind, this is God's view of marriage. It's a permanent thing. And to stray from that marriage and go do something else is a violation of that relationship, that covenant that's made the relationship. So, again, you see God's mind here. This is a permanent thing. Okay, so make sure your spouse knows that you aren't leaving. I'm here. I'm always going to be here. I love you. We've got the homework I have at the end of this. I'll email it out later on. It's going to be based on these three points here. And we're going to have one about this and discussing with each other how this is going in your particular marriage. But we want the relationship to be secure, to feel secure. We don't want conflicts to bring up this panic. Every time something happens, somebody leaves their socks on the floor, that we're worried is this going to be the thing that they leave me over this? You know, we can't have that tone, that tension in the marriage. We need to attack particular issues without being afraid that the marriage is going to break up over it. This has to just be, it's a given, we're together. Okay, now let me pause there. I said I was going to talk a lot, and I did. So let me pause here. Comments, questions, anything you want to add to this point? The permanence of marriage. Ed?
I think sometimes somebody could use this is if just one has that understanding and belief, you know, that we're supposed to be together, but the other one doesn't, where they could use that like over them and say, well, I could act any way I want to, you know, you're not going to leave me, so I can just do whatever I want to do.
Yeah.
And really, that's what they're doing in these Old Testament situations. They're acting like, I can do anything I want to. God will be there for me.
It's the abuse of that loyalty. Yeah.
And that's sin.
And that's wrong.
Yeah.
That happens all the time.
In a boat.
I didn't hear.
How long should you stay in the boat?
Oh, yeah, gotcha. Yeah, don't burn it while you're in it, right? Yeah.
Before you make that decision.
Well, the Bible doesn't say, you know, give a number or something like that,
but you definitely want to make sure that you both have this understanding about marriage, that that we're in it for the long term, we're in it for life before making that commitment. Keith?
Personal, not so humble belief, we allow the world to confuse us on a simple word called love. And that's kind of, to me, the basic of this. When I take what you're saying and water it down, the world wants to tell me love is an emotion. It is not. The Bible doesn't even approach it as an emotion if you go back through the verses, or if you go back through 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7. It is a decision. Love is a decision. If I say love is kind, what do I look about kindness? Well, that's my act. That's my decision to act. And if I go through those lists, we need to realize that love is a decision, and if we're going to commit to a decision, we just have to commit.
Yeah.
It can't be this little flighty thing of emotion, because emotions are flighty.
Yeah, emotions go up and down.
Yeah, that's right, and we'll talk about that more even in future classes where we go back to Ephesians 5 and talk about nourishing and cherishing, respecting and loving. And so the Bible uses the word in several different ways, and there's emotion involved in some of that, but you're right. One type of love is just the decision to do right. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. That wasn't an emotional decision. That was a commitment to send his son. So, yeah, that's definitely a main usage of love in the Bible. Okay? Anything else so far? Okay. A lot of times in marriage, we lash out, we bicker, we argue, we have these conflicts because of this. Maybe there's not that security that I know you're in it to stay, and I'm feeling like I'm in it to stay. And so littler things come up, and they tend to be things that come up over and over again. And really the underlying issue is not those particular things about maybe dishes or socks or something like that, but the underlying thing is I'm worried you're leaving me. And I'm worried this is going to be the issue that causes that, or I'm afraid of that, or I'm afraid you don't find me attractive, or I'm afraid you don't trust me. Or it's these deeper issues that manifest in these little things that we end up bickering about. And so this has to be the first step. Just biblically, permanent marriage. We're looking at it as a lifelong commitment. So we have to start with that understanding and try to reason with each other. You can imagine in the middle of an argument, sometimes just maybe putting that fear to rest. Look, we're going to figure this out. I don't know what the answer is going to be right now, but we're going to figure it out. The marriage is secure. We're fine. We're going to figure out what to do about this particular thing we're arguing about right now. And that might be enough right there to just relax things and help you deal with the issue instead of worrying about the marriage underneath the issue. JR?
I've seen in some marriages that was shared with me that a lot of times what's happened to us in our childhood with our parents and stuff has caused some underlying trust issues. And some people just have a hard time trusting that someone's really going to do what they say they're going to do, especially for something as important as marriage that's designed to be perfect, and you need to ferret that out during your time dating and being engaged and really talk to each other about trust, and what marriage is to be, what, you know, and what their expectation of their spouse is. And I think sometimes we get too caught up in the emotion and the fun of a relationship, a new relationship with someone, without getting into some of these deeper topics. And, you know, whether it's, you know, marriage counseling, I think, can bring that out. We didn't do that, but I know some others that have. But those conversations need to happen before you really, you know, either pop the question or you accept. I think it helps a lot if you cover that ahead of time.
Right. Yeah, exactly right.
One of the questions on my homework, did you ever feel abandoned or deserted by someone? Has that experience created any fears about our marriage? Exactly what you're talking about. You must have looked ahead at my homework somehow. John?
Say that marriage is an exercise in forgiveness. Could we align on that? That the fact is, if you want to trust somebody with experiences you've had or feelings or whatever it might be that's very near and dear to you, laying them out on the table to someone and having them squashed or ridiculed or condemned or put down or mocked can be devastating to a person. You can't have that in a marriage. So to the asking how long to stay in the boat, I would suggest staying in the boat at least until you know whether or not your potential future spouse is someone who can protect you. And that is an act of mercy, in a sense. That is an act of forgiveness. And I don't think it's not providential that, for example, when we get to Matthew 19, the last part of Matthew 18 is dealing with what? Forgiveness. You know, even though I know there's a little bit different in the timeline, it's funny to me how we're going from here to here. And he's talking about forgiveness. He's talking about being empathetic with your spouse. And I think you can't live successfully, I think, with someone who's merciless. And that, because you'll never live up to the standard.
Yeah, none of us do. And God's relationship with us is a good parallel in that. We're going to think about that a little bit
when we get to the third point here. You can trust me, their deepest feelings, but got to have forgiveness. We're going to have a future class just about forgiveness, patience, growing together, and so forth. Let me move to the second point here. My priority is to know you and share my life with you. Since God's command is for marriage to be permanent, it means that we'll need to put the necessary work in. Let's use another analogy, okay? Imagine marriage is a car. Let's do this. I've heard another preacher use this one, so maybe this one's better. I didn't come up with this one. Marriage is a car. So cars get old and you trade it in and get a new one. But let's say you could only have one car for the rest of your life. Would you do maintenance on that car? Oh, yeah. You'd do a lot of it. You'd be changing that oil all the time. Spark plugs, tires, all that, whole nine yards. You'd do a ton of maintenance if that's your only car. With zeal, lots of maintenance. Because you don't want to break down on the side of the road somewhere. That's marriage. You got your spouse. It's your only spouse the rest of your life. Put the maintenance in. Do the work. Get to know this one. Be an expert on this person. Of all the humans on the planet, I'm an expert on this one. I want to know her. I want to spend time with her. I want to share my life with her. That's the relationship that I want to maintain. This might be a good place to just remember how the Bible refers to marriage. A lot of times it doesn't even use the word marriage, but it refers to this person belongs to me or I belong to you and that sort of thing. Let me throw up a slide that we've used before. The Bible doesn't always use the word marriage to refer to marriage. It often uses a descriptive phrase. So in Genesis 2, man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So this is Adam and Eve, but this is a statement about not Adam and Eve because they didn't even have a father and mother, right? So about the relationship that a man would leave father and mother and be joined to his wife. So it might surprise us to realize the word marriage is not in Genesis 2. You got the first marriage, Adam and Eve. The word marriage is not even in the text anywhere there. This is as close as you get, a phrase like this, be joined to his wife. And remember, the word wife is just woman. Hebrew and Greek, same way. So the context, the phrasing is what helps us understand. It's talking about marriage. When Jesus is asked about divorce in Matthew 19:3, he goes back to Genesis 2, Adam and Eve, to answer the question. So they were married. There's no doubt about that. But here's the phrasing that's used. And so on throughout other passages. Deuteronomy 24, talks about becoming another man's. The word wife is not in the Hebrew there. Translators supply that in English to help us get the point. Deuteronomy 7:3, give your daughters and take their daughters, used in the context of marriage there if you read Deuteronomy 7. Ezekiel 16:8, you became mine. That's God figurative. Just like in Hosea, this is God being married to Israel again. Figurative marriage there, but it's that same phrasing, you became mine. 1 Corinthians 7, where it's talking especially about the sexual relationship, have his own wife, have her own husband is the way it's phrased there. Romans 7:3, she is joined to another man. Same idea. So I'm not suggesting that that phrasing alone teaches us, okay, that means you got to spend X number of hours with your spouse every week of undivided attention. But I do think it's worth noting just the way God conceives of it and the way he describes it. They're yours and you're theirs. You belong to each other. That's the way a lot of times it doesn't even use the word marriage. So again, the practical takeaway, do you think of it that way? I belong to you, you belong to me. We're an us. We're a couple, we're together, it's us. We belong to each other. When I was in college, one of my professor's daughters had just gotten married or was going to get married or something. He was talking to us about it in class one day and mentioned that in the ceremony, the officiant or preacher, whoever they had to do it, they had instructed not to say anything about becoming one because they said it's, so two independent people, and we don't want anything about becoming one. And, you know, it's literally, yes, you're two people still, but you're becoming each other's. You look at this biblical phrasing, not to mention that we didn't get into the phrase one flesh, but you become one flesh. So I think it's a biblical way to think about it. Look back at Deuteronomy chapter 24. Deuteronomy 24, just a little nugget back here, part of God's old covenant law, verse 5. Deuteronomy 24 and verse 5, when a man takes a new wife, he shall not go out with the army nor be charged with any duty. He shall be free at home 1 year and shall give happiness to his wife whom he has taken. Interesting that God tucked that into his old law here. No army deployments that first year of marriage, no duties in that first year of marriage. Stay home and build up that relationship. Interesting. So, again, God's view of marriage is, look, you're my priority. I am building my relationship with you. I'm your companion for life. Okay, what I want to do now is read a story to you. This is a lengthier story than or quote than I would normally read, but I think it's just such a good illustration of what we're talking about here, this biblical idea of I want to spend time with you, get to know you. We're companions for life. So, if you'll bear with me, this is a story, true story, out of a book. Rory was a pediatrician who ran an intensive care unit for babies. He was beloved at the hospital where everybody called him Dr. Rory. He was a reserved man, but capable of great warmth, humor, and charm. He was also a workaholic who slept in the hospital an average of 20 nights a month. He didn't know the names of his children's friends or even the name of the family dog. When he was asked which room led to the house's back door, he turned to ask his wife, Lisa. His wife was upset over how little she saw of Rory and how emotionally disconnected he seemed to be. She frequently tried to make little gestures to show him she cared, but her attempts just annoyed him. She was left with a sense that he simply didn't value her or their marriage. Okay, I've got more to read, but just to make sure we're getting it. Good guy, great doctor. If my baby was in that ICU, I would be glad he's there, I'm sure, taking care of my baby. But the marriage is also important. The kids are also important. And he didn't know anybody's names. He didn't know the name of the dog. He didn't know how to get to the back door of his own house. For years, his wife, Lisa, put up with his workaholism. But a turning point in the relationship occurred 1 year on Christmas Day when Rory was, of course, working. Lisa decided to pack a Christmas picnic and kids in tow surprise her husband at the hospital. As they ate together in the waiting room, Rory turned on Lisa, his face like an angry mask. He told her he resented being surprised with a picnic. Why did you do this? It's really embarrassing. Just then a resident called, and as Rory answered his phone, his face softened and his voice became helpful, warm, and friendly. When he hung up, he turned back to Lisa, his face again full of anger. Something snapped inside Lisa. Clearly her husband was capable of kindness, just not toward her. She packed up the picnic, took the kids home. Soon afterwards, she began going out in the evenings without him. After a while, Rory asked her for a divorce. But in a last-ditch effort to work out their differences, they decided to try marital counseling. At first, they got nowhere. When Lisa tried to be conciliatory toward Rory during their first session with a marital therapist, he was unable to respond in kind to her repair attempts. But their marriage's hidden hope was discovered when the couple agreed to be taped in my lab for a segment of a TV news show. The interviewer asked Rory and Lisa about their early years together. As Rory began to describe their first date, his face lit up. Here's a little of what they recalled. Rory said, "I think she was very nervous, and I had some background about why she was nervous, some cultural things that she was trying to live with. And because of this, I knew that this was going to take a long, long time. So I wasn't nervous at all. I figured this was stage one of a five-year marathon." Lisa said, "You mean you had a five-year plan on our first date?" Rory said, "Maybe that's exaggerating, but I knew it would take more than one lunch." She said, "Wow." Rory and Lisa actually held hands while they discussed this. Lisa was beaming. He had never before recounted his campaign to win her heart. This little vignette may not sound very dramatic. In fact, the TV show edited Rory and Lisa down to a snippet of airtime. But to a trained observer, there was much in this couple's interaction that offered hope for their marriage. Rory and Lisa's fond memories of their early days were evidence that underneath the antagonism, there were still glimmerings of what I call a fondness and admiration system. This means that they each retained some fundamental sense that the other was worthy of being respected and even liked. If a couple still have a functioning fondness and admiration system, their marriage is salvageable. I'm not suggesting that the road to reviving a marriage as troubled as Rory and Lisa's is easy, but it can be done. In 2 years, everything changed for this couple. Rory revised his work schedule. He trained a resident to take over much of the hospital work he'd been doing single-handedly. He began to eat dinner every night with Lisa and the children. He and Lisa also went to get out together in the evenings. Despite the agony they had put each other through, Rory and Lisa saved their marriage. Okay, you see the importance of doing things God's way. To make the decision, you're my companion, you're my priority, you belong to me and I belong to you, and I'm going to spend time with you because of the importance of that relationship. Okay, any comments, any questions before we move on? I got one more passage to read, then we'll do our third point real quick. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, please. You say, why are you reading this passage? This almost seems like it's against marriage, and it's not. But let me read verses 32 to 35. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 32. You might recall this passage, 1 Corinthians 7. There's some stuff going on in Corinth. There's some sort of distress mentioned in verse 26. In 1 Corinthians 7, 32, I want you to be free from concern. One who's unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. This I say for your own benefit, not to put a restraint upon you, but to promote what is appropriate and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. Okay, so this passage really is not about marriage. It's about the opposite. He is extolling the virtues of singlehood in this passage. And Paul, as far as we know, was always single. And he's saying, you know, the obvious, you have more time to devote to the Lord when you're not married, and especially given the present distress of verse 26. This passage is not saying it is wrong to marry. We're looking at a little snippet of it here. We need to just get that out there. It's not saying it's wrong to marry or to spend time on the marriage. That would contradict what he said earlier in the chapter, verses 3, 4, and 5. He said you got obligations to each other that keep Satan at bay. So all of that is still intact. Now, the point I want to emphasize here is it's just assumed here. This is an inspired text. It's just assumed here that marriage involves devoting yourself to that spouse. And so he's saying, you know, the good thing about single is you just got more time. Because when you're married, obviously, you're spending time on your spouse, which is right. And so that's kind of a counterpoint here, maybe a backhanded way of getting to that point. But, you know, Paul would not have been able to do what he did as a married man. It's kind of tough to tell your wife, okay, I'm going on another preaching trip. I'll see you in 4 years. Turn the page in chapter 9, 1 Corinthians 9, 5. Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Which seems to indicate that some of the other guys, the apostles, were taking their wives along with them as they were traveling and doing their work. But anyway, marriage takes time, and that means you just can't do certain things because of that time commitment. Again, the takeaway from all this is to make sure that we continue to spend time with our spouse. Talk to each other, dream and plan and console and relax and have fun and do all the things that we ought to be doing together. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion, but woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Ecclesiastes 4, 9, and 10. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Proverbs 18, 22. So last week, if you did the homework, the quiz, we were talking about how well do you know each other, and that kind of explored this idea. And maybe you did that a lot when you were dating. You know, if you can remember those days, however long it's been, and it was just so easy to do this. It just came naturally. You spend hours with each other. You look with goo-goo eyes at each other. You know, you just talk all the time, and I want to know all these things about you. And then maybe after marriage, that tapered off, trailed off for some reason, and you knew your spouse real good back then, 20 or 40 years ago, and then now, I'm not sure. What is she dreaming about now? What is she afraid of? I don't know. I hadn't talked about that stuff in a long, long time. So think about that. One therapist I know is taking to wearing a Bugs Bunny pin and advising couples that the key to sustaining a happy marriage is to ask periodically, what's up, doc? Okay, look in James chapter 5, please. Before we run out of time, let me jump to this third point real quick. This is the shortest point. You can trust me with your deepest feelings. James 5 and verse 16. Again, not a marriage passage, but I think it would include marriage. James 5, 16. Therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another so that you may be healed. The effective prayer of a righteous man can accomplish much. Okay, so we might confess our sins to any trustworthy person, brother or sister in Christ. But what about our spouses? Can I trust my spouse that I can open up my deepest, darkest stuff to them? And they're not going to abuse that or exploit that in some bad way, but they're going to have my soul's best interest. Or in the spirit of Galatians 2, they're going to help me get restored. They're going to help me bear that burden. Can I trust them with the deep, dark stuff? Back in Proverbs 17, 9, this is an interesting proverb. Proverbs 17 and verse 9. He who conceals a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates intimate friends. Okay, that first half, you know, sometimes these proverbs, it's like a first half and second half, and this is one of those. And sometimes one half will help you interpret the other half. So the first half of verse 9, he who conceals, your translation might say covers, he who covers a transgression seeks love. That does not mean ignore sin. You know, just pretend, sin's no big deal, just ignore it. The second half helps us understand it, that he who repeats a matter separates intimate friends. Okay, so this is talking about once a sin is dealt with, it's repented of, quit bringing it up. Quit repeating it. Quit using this as a wedge. That drives people apart. We just keep repeating the old stuff from days gone by. It's already taken care of. It's dealt with. Don't tell the story for the next 20 years. Okay, so can my spouse trust me to let things go? Things that need to be let go, things that have been dealt with. Can my spouse trust me to let things go? And, you know, obviously that affects how I can have a conversation now. If I can talk honestly and openly now because I know you're not going to exploit some deep, dark thing if I reveal that to you. One more passage, 1 Corinthians 13, then I'll open it up for comments. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 4, in reference to love, love is patient. Love is kind and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant. Does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own. Is not provoked. Does not take into account a wrong suffered. Does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. Bears all things. Believes all things. Hopes all things. Endures all things. And we'll have a class, Lord willing, in the future about forgiveness and patience and all that with each other. But just notice the unselfishness of love. Love is motivating me and willing to move forward and see the best in others, especially my spouse. So hopefully I would have maybe several people in my life who are trusted confidants, but especially my spouse, the one who has vowed to be my companion for the rest of our lives. Hopefully I can have that kind of relationship with them. Okay, we got 6 minutes left. Comments, questions? Let's talk about all this stuff. What do you want to say? Okay, let me start talking about the homework, and then you can start talking when you want to. I'm here for you and always will be. I'm suggesting you have some conversations with your spouse. Are you fully devoted to this marriage as a lifelong relationship? Is there anything I say or do that makes you worried that I might leave? What makes you afraid that I'm not all in? Is there anything I say or do that makes you feel confident that I'm here to stay? What makes you feel safe and secure? And then here's what I read earlier. Did you ever feel abandoned or deserted by someone? Has that experience created any fears about our marriage? Sometimes we're affected by some earlier thing, and I just have a trouble trusting somebody. And maybe we need to talk about that. My priority is to know you and to share my life with you. So if you were to draw a pie chart, you don't have to actually draw one, but just think, where's my time and attention going? Work, hobbies, friends, kids, organizations? Where does my spouse fit into all that? And obviously, God's the center of everything. Are you comfortable with how much time and mental energy you're devoting to your spouse? And is he or she? Now, here's the big time commitment this week. I'm suggesting set aside 20 or 30 minutes each evening to talk to each other. How was your day? And just keep in touch. What happened today? What's going on? What's happening? Be genuinely interested. Ask questions. See if you can do that for a week. And then the third one, you can trust me with your deepest feelings. And I'm suggesting you don't have to make goo-goo eyes, but just look in their eyes. Tell them how you truly feel about them. Tell them what you love about them. Tell them what you're hoping for the future of your relationship. Just put yourself out there and try to develop some trust. Okay. Comments? Daniel?
In the Bible where Paul says that he would rather people be as he is, single. But then there are other passages where it encourages young widows to get married. And it seems like it might be a contradiction, but I think what the overall point is, it's easier to be a married Christian than to be a single Christian. Sometimes maybe people look at their marriages and think it would be easier to be single. But from a Christian perspective, it's easier to be a married Christian than a single Christian. I think maybe that's what Paul was talking about. It's possible.
Okay.
But it's easier to be a Christian if you have another Christian to help.
Okay, yeah.
And in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul, of course, that present distress there, we keep all that in its context, and then is it 1 Timothy 5 where the young widows are told to get married because they're young, and he's talking there about gossip and some other temptations that are going to come in, and he doesn't want them to get mixed up in that, and so he says, better for you to get married. And so, yeah, keeping all that in its context. And like we said last time, look, Paul lived, far as we know, his whole life. He's single. He's devoted to Christ. Great way to live. You can live a fulfilling, happy life devoted to Christ. But there's benefit to marriage, and to find a wife is to find a good thing. So we extol that as well. Wyatt?
Brought up the homework. I can't remember. What did you say that?
That's what you may remember last week.
I mean.
About the homework?
I mean, when you were telling us to fill it out, what were you saying about if we weren't married?
I don't remember.
Couldn't remember exactly what you said.
I don't know. I mean, generally, I would say I hope that everybody can get something out of this class. If you're not yet married, you can look forward and be thinking about these things. I might have said something along those lines. I can't remember what. Sorry. Questions, comments, anything else to add to our study this morning? Who's that back there? Yes, ma'am.
The one thing that came to my mind while you were talking about this is in the companionship. Generally speaking, when people are dating, they put the other one first. They want to do something to please that person, make them happy. That has got to continue into the marriage. You need to put the other person first. There's a lot of scriptures that don't talk about just marriage, but one another commandments. And I think if you look up all the one another commandments in the New Testament, you'll see that actually puts you putting the other person first.
Okay.
I love that you said that. How long were y'all married, by the way?
66 years.
66, okay. So
put each other first. Thank you. Brent?
Car analogy. I think that it's very easy to ruin a car the first few years you get it. Uh-huh. And it's a good thing that when we're first married, we're not the most young and the most immature and the most hot-headed and the most everything. And, you know, as you spend so many years together, you get to where you just know what the other one's going to do. There's less conflict, or at least That seems what I've observed. But boy, you can really say some hurtful things in those first years and set it on a bad course.
Yeah, yeah.
You really need to be careful about that.
That's a great
from
point.
My experience.
That's
I
a great point. Yeah. Okay, that does it for our time. So good luck with the homework. Be glad for y'all to participate with that. Thank you for your attention today.